Hello, and welcome to the Sunshine Sound Podcast with your host, Christine Mathias.
One thing that I'll think a lot about when I'm teaching adults is like, you know, I want them to do something at a faster BPM, and they just won't do it because they're scared of messing up. Whereas a kid will just like be like, okay, I'm going to crank up the metronome, and then they'll go at it, and, you know, they'll fuck up like 50 times in a row, but the 51st time they'll do it. And, you know, they'll adjust accordingly. Whereas if you don't have that mindset where you can be okay with yourself failing, then you can't reach the next level.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 6 of the Sunshine Sound Podcast. So in this one, I interview Matt Rakers and Ryan Bradley of Fist Fights with Wolves. And they are a progressive math rock band based here in San Diego. Ryan is the guitarist and Matt is the keyboardist and composer, and he also runs the San Diego Music and Arts Cooperative, which actually all of the members of Fist Fights have had some involvement with that organization. So this was a fun interview because these guys were actually the first guests that I've had so far where I did not know them beforehand. And I'm not sure if or when our paths would have crossed if it was not for this interview. So that's pretty cool. So we talk about a lot of stuff here. We talk about what it's like to compose and practice and perform in a progressive rock band. And of course, we'll learn more about their band, the history of it, and take a listen to a few of their tracks. And we also talk about things like the difference between the classical music and the rock music worlds. And it's all about their organization, you know, why they started it, why it's needed, what they do, and their experience with teaching. So I think these guys have some really great perspective. There's a lot of stuff to learn here, and it was really interesting. So I hope you enjoy. I guess to jump into it, because your band is a progressive math rock band, which is really cool. I feel like you don't see a lot of that in San Diego. And so I'm curious, like, what's been your experience playing prog rock and like how you got into that and like what is even the definition of progressive rock now?
You can start.
Okay. As far as like what I think the definition is, I think typically it's just throughout the entire history of progressive rock, it's more like about forward movement and complexity. With us specifically, like Matt and I met at going to school for music, and so we're both like classically trained. I did jazz studies, and so really bringing in those elements of like everything that we've learned in at a higher level and bring it into a setting that's more going to be with other genres of just like standard rock, you know. Do you have anything
about progressive rock?
Yeah.
I grew up with it. I'm half Japanese, so my mother forced me to learn piano, and my dad's like a big white dude, so I listened to a bunch of his prog rock and psychedelic rock albums. So that was sort of the background.
So like what were you listening to growing up that you feel like influenced you now?
Well, my first piano teacher made me learn like exclusively Chopin. And then I was listening to like Genesis when I was like 8 years old. And I was probably the only 8-year-old Japanese kid in Ohio running around screaming the lyrics to The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. But then in high school, I like came across the Velvet Underground, self-titled, and kind of realized like, oh, like I could make music and sort of rediscovered music at that point and did like a lot of folk music and stuff like that.
Do you feel like that folk music also has a presence in the music that you write now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that progressive rock and math rock have a tendency to be a little, I don't want to say too esoteric, but removed from the listener in certain aspects, whereas folk music maybe goes too far in the direction of being for the listener. Mm. And so it's nice to create those entry points within a piece for the listener to kind of gravitate towards something they recognize and then be subversive and put in, you know, the weird shit. We're allowed to say shit, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a podcast. It's okay. The Wild West.
Not really.
God fucking damn it.
Yeah.
All right.
Right on. Yeah, I think our music definitely, even when we're playing something like in switching time signatures or harmonies that people don't normally listen to, there's still going to be some element of like a very singable melody that you can grasp onto and like have this expectation of something that's like anyone can pay attention to.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to put it, that it's almost like some music, it's the first time you listen to, you can understand it better. It sounds like music you've listened to before. And maybe with progressive and more experimental music, I think it does ask more from the listener.
Yeah.
Maybe have to listen to it a few times before you get what's going on. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, inherently it's a little bit selfish in the sense that, like, you know, when we were starting out, is we were a band called Interrobang. And we were instrumental, but the music, while probably complex by San Diego standards, it was a lot simpler than what we do now. And we just got like bored playing it. You know, you repeat the same set for like 6 months, a year, record it, and you end up hearing the same dumb songs like, you know, 2,000 times. And then you're like, why am I doing this? And so you just... As creators, you start making it more complex so you have something new to focus on.
Sure.
Yeah. So,
yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, in a way, like anything you create is somewhat selfish, has to be somewhat for yourself. It's interesting. Last podcast I was talking to Ken, who's this guy who played in a top 40 band for over 20 years. So, different kind of background experience, but that's what he enjoyed doing, and ultimately he wasn't even, you know, making a living doing that either. So it's ultimately, I feel like when you're playing music, you have to do what you love and do what inspires you, you know.
Yeah, don't go into it expecting to be successful.
Right. yeah
Okay,
so where did the name come from?
So long story, short story is an Excel spreadsheet where we vote it. But the longer story is, we were in a band called Interrobang, and we ended up pissing off a handful of local promoters, and we weren't allowed to play shows at certain places anymore.
What happened there?
Well, when we were starting out, we were being asked to play with larger local bands like Burning of Rome or Science Fiction Jazz, and we were being asked to open for them, so we'd get to play, you know, these larger shows that, you know, bands are starting out wouldn't necessarily be able to play. And we were trying to book, like, I think a Monday night. It was a Monday night.
Probably.
Yeah, the fucking Griffin.
Yeah.
Right? Like, which just, had, you know, usually 5 to 10 people on a Monday night.
Yeah, and just a standard dive bar that happens to have a stage in it.
Sure.
So the booker goes through our social media and sees that we're playing with these bigger bands. And he's like, yeah, you guys can open, but you have to get one of these larger bands to open for you, or else you can't play.
To close.
That's close.
Was it to close? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So we were going to be the opener on a Monday night at the Griffin with, like, Burning of Rome headline.
Yeah.
And he wanted you to get
that band, like, to...
That was the demand for us to be able to be booked. When I asked him about it, he was like, or you can bring 100 people out.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, is challenging for a dive bar. And I think that was, like, maybe 10th show. But
so you said a booker, like, you had a booker for your band?
There was a promoter for making the quotes venue in the air, but there was a promoter. And so I emailed him back and like asked him to clarify, and eventually he just was like, yeah, you need to do these things in order to play here. And I took our whole email thread with him and put it on our website and tagged all the bands. And that pissed off a lot of people.
Wow.
So was that
the promoter for that venue, or is it just someone?
Okay. Well, I mean, like, what happens is a lot of the venues, at least this was like 6 or 7 years ago, they were working with different promoters who would basically act as bookers. But what the promoters would do is they'd take 50% cuts from the bands. And so what some of them were doing is they'd book multiple shows on a single night and then take 50% cuts from multiple shows they wouldn't promote. And so the promoters were doing okay for themselves and the bands were making jack shit.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
San Diego.
is that still going on now, that practice?
No, I mean, there's definitely been a change.
Yes, yeah. I haven't experienced that, but I haven't been here that long.
Yeah. Yeah, I think back then it was more of like this kind of weird monopoly that a few people had over like the small music scene. It wasn't even like big venues or anything like that. And yeah, we had some people not book us because they told us that we were this other promoter's band. Like,
yeah, the promoters like have like territories. It was weird. Like sometimes we'd try to go directly to owners and then we'd be referred out to the promoters and like, yeah, but now it's a lot different. Mm-hmm. I think, now there's definitely more owner run venues. Like, Black Cat is great. Blonde Bar, is great. You know, there's quite a few places.
Whistle Stop
now
is always really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to how that created the name
after
that long little road we went down. So we decided also there was a bunch of other bands in the internet world that were popping up called Interrobang. So we decided that we should change our name just to like separate ourselves from what had been going on.
There's other bands with that name?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Punctuations are very popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Excel spreadsheet came up and we all like submitted band names, right?
Yeah. Well, originally I wanted Fist Fights with Ghosts.
Yeah. But specifically, this came up, someone, I think it was Pete at the time, suggested something about Liam Neeson.
he talked about Liam Neeson.
He talked about Liam Neeson a lot. And
it's dreamy.
And I was, the reference to the movie The Gray came up.
Hmm.
If you're not familiar with that, it's about Liam Neeson is part of this like deep Alaskan oil mining crew. And they're coming back home and their plane crashes in the Alaskan wilderness.
Which is what we'd like to focus on.
and anyways, they have to somehow try to survive with nothing, fighting off these wolves that start hunting them. So I made the joke, it's like dances with wolves, but fist fights with wolves. And then
I was like, well, that's a dumb story. So let's make it about the promoters.
That's great.
But we have a lot to say about Alaska and mining.
Mining.
There's
wolves.
Not enough progressive rock music about either topic.
Yeah. Does that come up in your songs? Has it?
Mostly.
Mostly. Yeah, that's great. So like what your songs are really epic, I think is a good word for them. Like so do you Matt, do you compose the entire, like you put together the lyrics, all the pieces,
usually,
or what does that look like?
I take a photo of Ryan out of my pocket and I gaze deeply into his beard and I start writing. That's where most of my inspiration comes from. Yeah, my goal is to have a song for each of his beard hairs.
Wow.
It's going to take a long
time.
You
could be at it a long time.
Eventually, your beard will bald, too. So the songwriting process.
So, like, do you write, so when you give it to the band, like, do you have all the parts written out for all the...
No, it depends on the song. I mean, some of them are certainly more collaborative. We're pretty open-minded in the project, so... Like, you know, Ryan might come with a riff and then we'll flesh it out and then I'll develop it, usually structure it, write melodies, lyrics, things like that. So on one hand, sometimes I will score a majority of the music. In other scenarios, we, you know, improvise or jam around on it and that becomes the source material for the composition.
Yeah, I think a lot of our first set of music was mostly just like improvising around an idea for the most part, and then more as time went on, it's definitely become a lot more like composed beforehand and then work on it as a group kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's like probably about 90% composition, 10% improvisation though.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. And when you say work on it together, is that the whole eight piece working on it together?
We do a lot of
duo writing. I'll work a lot with the singers. The singers hate me. I usually write really awkward melodies with very little opportunity to breathe.
And with with no thought to their range.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's fuck 'em.
That's harsh. And so the eight piece that you have now, what is the instrumentation?
Me on guitar, Matt plays keyboard and guitar.
Then at the same time.
With my teeth.
We have Nathan is our bass player. We have Kevin and Billy are both of our drummers.
We have two drummers.
Like also
two full kits. Yeah. And then two singers, Latifa and Anastasia. And then we just added our saxophonist, Malcolm.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And has it always been that size? You said you just added the saxophonist.
No,
but
I think when we first started out, we were doing shows as a two-piece using delay pedals and loopers.
This was a long time ago.
And then we've bounced back and forth between probably, usually a five-piece. Sometimes a three-piece, sometimes now an eight-piece.
Yeah.
But eventually we'll be a 10-piece, and then a 20-piece, and then we'll just assimilate everyone. Yes.
This project, it's mostly we've been, working with the musicians that we have available, you know? And I think since we've stuck at it so long and been in the community so long, the options that we've had has been, growing. Mm-hmm. So, at this point, we just have a bunch of really good musicians that we really like, and we're able to all be together and just work as an eight piece. Nice. So we might as well keep it that size.
Yeah. So do you, where do you find the musicians? Is it just people you met in community? Do you ever put up an ad on Craigslist?
I guess this is where we can segue a little bit into the studio.
Oh, yeah.
Every musician teaches for or has taught for the San Diego Music and Art Cooperative.
Oh, yeah, cool. Mm-hmm.
So, and we basically just pull people from, the local universities. Yeah. So,
What do you mean you pull people? You reach out to them?
Sometimes. I mean, we like hiring friends of friends and... Mm-hmm. There's a lot of nepotism.
There is in every company, I think.
Right now it's nice because there's a really good practicing environment. So all the individual musicians and the artists we have in studio are working hard at their crafts. And so we tend to get a more serious type of musician that we get to work with.
Yeah.
Cool. So go ahead.
I was just going to say that, we have the musicians are the teachers, but we also, the space encourages, being creative and, not just using it to teach, be able to go there to practice, be able to go there to write, be able to go there and,
Catan.
Play Catan.
That's probably the most important part.
Yeah.
Wait, what is that?
Oh, Settlers of Catan.
She doesn't know how to settle.
No, I think I've heard of this.
Okay. It's all right.
It's a board game.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So take a step back and tell us what is the San Diego Music and Arts Cooperative?
So this is a project I started basically in response to a lot of the more exploitative music studios in town. In which they were basically paying, teachers really small commissions on the hour for their work. And artists were getting paid hourly wages instead of commission, so they were making a lot less. And so, it's hopefully as it grows, it will become more of this. But I wanted to facilitate being able to create careers for independent working musicians and artists so they could compete with the more exploitative studios.
Very cool. So you have lessons the core of
lessons is the core. We do about between 220 and 250 lessons a week right now.
Nice.
And we have about 15 instructors.
Wow. So are the instructors like working full time for you?
Some of the teachers are working more. Currently, I think there's myself, Jessica Siemens, and then she's an artist, and a few other artists and musicians are getting close to that point. But for the most part, even when you're looking at quotes again, full-time private teachers, they're teaching, if they're teaching like 30 to 35 hours a week, that's, 50 students.
That's a lot.
So, yeah, that's a challenging amount of people to deal with.
Yeah.
Deal with and be able to maintain as well. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how long have you been doing that, running that organization?
So this is now year four.
Nice.
Yeah. So, it's growing and it's providing a really nice exchange of creativity and ideas for the people that are there. And so, it's I feel lucky.
Yeah. And it sounds like it's not only giving lessons, but you've kind of created a community of musicians, like have people like met each other there and formed projects and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of pretty much what we're doing.
Yeah.
So Fist Fights with Wolves and Belladon, Latifatron, now Phantom Twins. Those are the music projects that are based out of there. Then Shrub Bravo. You should have him on this podcast.
Yeah.
That would be ridiculous. Cool.
Yeah, actually, that would be awesome.
Yeah, you probably just let him talk for like an hour. there's a number of projects. This summer we're hoping to get Jazz Combo going, and hopefully in the fall, Classical Ensemble.
Awesome. Cool. And where is it?
It's located off of Miramar Road.
Nice.
Right by the 15.
Cool. And so, do you also have like practice space or?
Yeah. It's a 4,000 foot space, and we have a 2,000 foot warehouse where we throw events and like recitals and things. Our next event is Cinco de Mayo. We're doing a fundraiser for the San Diego Food Bank.
Cool. That's really cool.
And we also do art shows. Like, it kind of doubles as a gallery.
Yeah. Nice. So the May 5th event is going to be loosely themed around rebellion in honor of Cinco de Mayo. But nice. Honeychild is coming down from Los Angeles. They're like an all-girl chamber folk group.
Yeah. Were they like six apiece? Five or six?
I think they're seven.
Seven.
Yeah. Okay. But they write really pretty music. And then locally, Fist Fights is playing. And then Finnegan Blue and Abnormal Mammal. And they're both comprised of like local jazz guys.
Cool. And so how much are tickets?
Free.
No way. Yeah. How is it a fundraiser?
All the beer sales are going to the San Diego Food Bank. And then we have a bucket for food donations.
Mm-hmm. And
then if you buy any art, proceeds are going to the food bank.
Very cool.
And the artists.
Yeah. Yes. Awesome. I love it. Like I think that there's not enough like spaces around here that like to have stuff like this. So that's really cool.
I think San Diego's a little hard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the DIY scene.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think because rent is so expensive. Mm-hmm. Was that a struggle for you guys to find a space?
Yeah. Starting out was pretty rough.
And our first space was like, we didn't know at the time, but was basically like taking advantage of us.
Nope, don't say that. Cut that.
It was it wasn't a good fit for you.
No,
we'll say.
We were really helped out at the start. We just didn't know very much about the situation.
Sure. You learn.
Yeah, we went from basically being in like 1,000 foot space, and then we kind of outgrew it, and then we recently expanded about 6 months ago.
Hmm.
So yeah, things are moving, things are looking up.
Awesome. Yeah. Good deal. And then so you said that you met, that's where you met some of the members of Fist Fights, or that all of the members have taught there or teach there?
Everyone teaches. So our drummer, one of our drummers, Kevin Capasia, he got his like master's from CSU Long Beach in composition, and he's like a trained pianist, so he teaches piano and drums at the studio. Our other drummer, Billy, he's like a drumline captain or something, right? So he teaches drums, and then my girlfriend Anastasia, she majored in jazz singing, so she teaches voice and piano. And I could go on, but it's a boring list.
A lot of really talented musicians. Yeah, definitely. Cool. So you sent me a few tracks, and I'd love to play one of them right now. So one of them, well, I don't want to make sure I'm saying this right. It's Mod Dib. Is that how you say it?
No, try again.
No, no. Well, how do you say it?
Just keep going.
So mod, is that the mode?
You haven't,
it's close.
Close.
Mode?
You haven't read much sci-fi.
No.
Yeah.
What is it?
Mod Dib.
Mod Dib. So it sounds more French.
It just means desert mouse.
Yeah.
In what?
In a made up language.
Oh, right. I didn't learn that one.
It's from Dune.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. So. Cool. So yeah, we'll take a break here to listen to that track, and then we'll talk about it.
Call Luke.
And we're back. That was a really cool track. Even though we didn't actually listen to it now, I did listen to it before the podcast, I'll have you know. And I would say it's another really epic piece. I feel like cool. Everything I've listened to from you guys is epic.
Well, so, they're long. They're yeah. Long.
Maybe that's another
really
word.
Nice way of saying long.
I mean, it just, there's a lot of, like, I feel like different themes and different parts to it. It's not just your typical verse, chorus, bridge, verse, you know, outro. Like you,
yeah.
It's, I think it's more structured, kind of like a classical piece, which I think kind of makes sense with your background.
Yeah. Generally, actually, when we start out with a song, it is in like that AB kind of format, which is pretty standard to pop. But that's a really nice launching point for everything else. And so Maldeeb structurally, there's Ryan's intro where he's doing those nice chords over...
volume swells.
Is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, that's what...
It sounds kind of like a chordal melody, but if you want to call it volume swells, that works too. But he does that, and then we launch into this verse, which is where we introduce the time changes. And so we're doing a three-cycle rhythmic group where we're in, what is it, four, and five?
Four, four, five, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and I really like those stutters because it kind of forces the listener to pay attention to things that might otherwise seem conventional. And then those rests are where we do the time changes, and the rests happen in cycles of two beats, three beats, and that's where the vocals are introduced later on. So like having that space and then having it filled out is really nice. And then the chorus itself too, I guess we can call it a chorus.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Chorus. Sure, the chorus part, the part where we get louder and it happens twice. That's also in kind of an unusual grouping of chords, even though it's in 4-4. But after that, I think it's pretty conventional, even though we go into the weird, like, desert music.
I don't know if that's conventional, but
it seems conventional. It's like we repeat the same thing a bunch of times.
It's just a repetitive groove going on.
Yeah. Which is also unusual for our set. Yeah. But the return at the end when we come back to like something that's more recognizable, that's actually the entire vocal line from the beginning. Just repeat it over this more Latin sounding verse.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So when you're practicing or performing this, are you just counting in your head constantly, or does it get to a point where you can just feel it?
It's remarkable how everything that was once interesting can become boring. I think like that's really key, is having so many repetitions of something where it becomes second nature, and then getting to the point where it seems like a cliche. So the next set of music you make is different and better.
Sure.
Yeah. So yeah, we just don't have to, we don't count. To
you don't,
it's
sure.
More felt.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to go point, on stage like, with like music stands or anything. Or
our bass
you?
Player, it still does.
No, he doesn't.
No, he still has it there.
Are you serious? Yeah.
I don't think he's looking at it all the time. Is.
Yeah. Well, yeah. He's been hiding it well. Latifah hasn't memorized, our newest singer, she hasn't memorized the set yet. But we're gonna talk about that.
Just the lyrics, though. It's a lot of lyrics.
Who cares about the lyrics?
But do you think, like, making that transition from, or if it was a transition, but going back and forth between like kind of classical music and rock music, like classical music, you like always have a music stand in front of you. Like, do you think that was challenging to go to rock music?
I think that the more challenging aspect is, it makes you kind of alienate it in both situations, where, you know, the classical musicians are like, why aren't you playing classical music? Like, you have the skill set. And the rock musicians are like, why do you know stuff? Don't know stuff. It's rock. So, yeah, I mean, like, it kind of puts you in a weird situation where both sides don't really understand each other. But it's an interesting duality.
Yeah.
I mean, for me coming from guitar is mostly you kind of have to memorize a lot of what you're doing in order to actually like be able to execute everything, because you need to actually have your like visualize your hands a lot more. So you can't be in looking in two places at once. So I'm more used to just memorizing whatever I'm playing. So there's that. That's more natural for me, I guess.
Sure. And that makes sense. Yeah. I think like when you, at least for me, when I memorize music, it's like you can just experience it more. I feel like the music stand could be kind of a crutch if you have it for too long, but I don't know.
It's interesting. I mean, like memorization is certainly a large aspect of doing, you know, advanced classical music. Certainly there's plenty of things you can't do without memorization, but also the way you interact with a score changes as you go into more complex things. For example, you know, when you first start learning a piece, your interaction with the sheet music is going to be entirely different than 3 months after you've looked at it every day. And certain things, you know, compositionally will jump out at you and structurally will jump out at you that perhaps in memory can be lost. That's not to say that isn't a valid way of doing things, but, you know, being able to see like the architecture of a section versus being in the moment with a phrase is completely different. Mm-hmm. And being able to plan out how you're going to phrase something throughout the course of like 20 pages versus like, you know, a couple minutes is different.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And so do you still play any classical music in any other projects?
Oh, yeah. Not in projects. I study classical music for myself and for teaching. Last week I started working on another Bach prelude and fugue, you know, and it's not because I'm going to go out and perform a Bach prelude and fugue. It's because, you know, I want to push myself. And, I think that's the trait everyone, you know, at the studio has in common.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I think a lot of musicians can kind of, they get up to a certain point and then there's different ways to approach music, so there's not anything wrong with it. But I think that for some musicians, they get to a certain point, they have the songs that they're comfortable with playing, and they're good with that. But it sounds like you guys are the type of musicians that want to continually push yourselves. Yeah.
Just like, I'm not good enough.
Oh, no, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's no matter how good you get, I think there's always someone out there better. There's always a different composer who's doing something that you can't do, and you have to, like, take that time to actually like reflect on that, and if you want to gain those abilities, it takes practice, you know. So I mean, I don't think that I'll ever want to stop continuing to learn new pieces or learn new styles or anything like that.
Do you think there are certain things that you're not great at now or don't know how to do that you're really trying to learn how to do?
I mean, there's always things we're working on. At this point, you know, I don't feel like I did when I was like 19 and writing music, where it's like this big task that seems really hard to do. There's a lot more flow and it's a lot more organic. So, you know, if I sit down and I say, okay, I'm going to write a piece, then I can write a piece. And it just comes out a lot more naturally. But I think, you know, maybe the first 150 or 200 pieces of music, it was more challenging than it is now.
And do you think that the learning music as an adult is different than it was when you were a kid, or like trying to learn new skills, or even like working with your students that you have? Like, what do you think the difference is between adult students and kid students?
I think it's the tendency to be more aware of seeing things down the road, I guess, that like a lot of students are like, why are you making me do this? Like, what, like, you keep telling me, I keep telling you to put your thumb on the back of the neck every lesson, and then they don't do it because they don't understand that, you know, you have to build that habit and that you are going to, that's going to benefit you later on. You know, they're just doing what's comfortable. Whereas an adult, I think, will listen to you and understand that you, as a teacher, like, I've gone through all of that, and like, I'm giving you this information because eventually you're going to need to use it in a certain way, you know? So I think that's it. Like, I think kids have a tendency not to really look past what they're doing day to day, you know?
Right, so. Right.
Yeah, I think with adults, a lot of times they're looking for, like, cheap psychotherapy, you know? Whereas with children, you can actually, like, really build a musician. And it takes a lot of years, and it helps if you have Asian parents. But yeah, adult students can be very satisfying if they improve. But there's usually a lot of ego involved with adults and preconceived notions of things. And a lot of times, even if they don't know a lot, they're very proud of what they do know, and it creates lots of problems.
Yeah.
But kids are cool.
Yeah, I think also, yeah, with kids, a lot of it has to do with kind of working on teaching the parents too.
Because
apparently there isn't a test for that. It does your junk work.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also in my experience of doing a little bit of teaching at music camps that it, like, kids are kind of in the mind frame of like, I'm not good at anything, I'm a kid. And like adults, it's like they expect, like, I'm an adult, I should know how to do everything. So it's kind of like you have to remember what it's like to be a kid again. And I think that can be hard for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kids, they take risks that adults don't take. And, like, one thing that I'll think a lot about when I'm teaching adults is, like, you know, I'll want them to do something at a faster BPM. And they just won't do it because they're scared of messing up. Whereas a kid will just, like, be like, okay, I'm going to crank up the metronome, and then they'll go at it. And, you know, they'll fuck up, like, 50 times in a row. But the 51st time, they'll do it. And, you know, they'll adjust accordingly. Whereas if you don't have that mindset where you can be okay with yourself failing, then you can't reach the next level a lot of times. So that's kind of a weird dilemma. And it's something you can't really teach. You can, like, maybe facilitate a realization, but more often than not, not really. You know?
That's interesting. I mean, I wonder if there is a way to be aware of that as an adult and push yourself knowing that it's there. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think.
Maybe call their parents.
Also, like, a lot of, if you're just getting into music as an adult, there's not always, you don't always have a background of performance, where you've gone through the kind of cycle of having to perform and being nervous in front of other people and, like, making mistakes and, like, no, it's fine. You're still alive. Mm-hmm. Like, everything's fine. So.
Is it, Ryan?
So yeah, I think there's that mindset that you need to get over is, yeah, it's going to be okay to do something wrong.
Like, yeah. So do you guys, what with your bands, it just seems like there's little room for mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're usually pretty mean to each other. Yeah. There's mistakes.
Yeah.
So, like, how much do you guys practice?
We practice just once a week.
Yeah, but, as a group, once a week. But, I mean, there's...
Individually, we all practice a lot.
Yeah.
You know? I couldn't play that music if I just only played it once a week and then whenever we played shows, you know.
Yeah,
I have to run through it, you know, every so often.
Yeah. All right, let's listen to another one of your tracks. You also I think I can pronounce this one. Plot Armor.
Nope.
Yeah? No?
try again.
Did I write it down?
You're right. You're
oh, man. All right. Let's have a listen.
Speaking, or are we simply feeding secondary?
Okay, we're back. All right, that was a cool track. So tell me about that one.
So do you know the piece Clair de Lune?
Yeah.
The second page, I stole the rhythm.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. Just giving away all the secrets.
I know. That's the only thing I took.
Where it started?
I thought it would be cool as an ostinato.
What does ostinato mean?
It's a repeating musical pattern.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I thought it would be cool to do something like that. And then I like messing around with a compositional concept called augmentation, which is where you take a phrase or an idea and you have it a certain length the first time. Let's say it's, 16 beats the first time. And then the second time it comes back, it's 18 beats or something like that. But I did that with the chord progression in this case. So it goes from being a 2-chord progression to a 4-chord progression, and then evolves into a very long chord progression with the same beginning, which has, to me at least, it has a more momentum in terms of its build. So it gets that more, I guess, epic factor.
Mm.
Is that the mm-hmm. right use of the word?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of energy to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then keeping the chord progression from resolving for a longer period of time builds suspense. So, yeah, that was the idea around the beginning. And then lyrically, for this set of music, because, we're teachers and we have to work with people from a variety of different backgrounds, including Christians or other religions or Chinese people or whatever. We can't be really blatant about what we want to say all the time. So I tend to be more abstract with the lyric writing and, So that's the lyrics for the piece.
Hmm. So interesting. So you're somewhat concerned about your organization and the music that you put out?
Oh, absolutely. Hmm. Yeah. So unfortunately for this time period in my life, I have to be more abstract about things, except this interview. So no one read into anything. But for the most part, I just like the music that is being written right now. I want to be something that people have to think about a little bit to arrive at, their idea of what's going on. And I want to be something that, maybe the first listen is interesting enough that you'll listen to it a second time.
Hmm.
And then hopefully, you have to listen to it 7 or 8 times to really get what each composition is about.
Sure. Yeah.
Song. Each song.
Very
first
cool.
First chorus.
That should be our mantra.
I like it. So do you guys have any shows coming up?
The next one. Yeah, the next one's going to be the Cinco de Mayo show.
Cool.
Yeah. What's the one that we're doing? The 23rd? Oh, but that's on the radio.
Oh, yeah, we're playing at Not So Serious Radio, Palomar College.
Palomar College Radio, we'll do it. It's a live broadcasted performance, though, too. And if you go on their Facebook page, you can find the link to watch it and everything.
Nice.
And that's going to be on May 23rd.
Cool. And then after that is the Punk Rock Food Drive.
Yeah.
What's that? Is that also at your organization?
No, this one's... It's on my phone, which I turned off. For this. But if you look up Punk Rock Food Drive, you can find out about it.
Yeah, it's a band, Parade of Horribles, local punk two-piece bass and drums. They've been doing, I think this, I don't know how many years.
I think this is their 16th event or something. They've raised $25,000.
Yeah, oh. So they'll usually partner with, I think it's always with breweries. And they'll just do have people come in, same thing, food drive, bring donations, bring food and everything, and hang out at a brewery.
Nice. Yeah. So what is that do you guys usually play with like punk bands or like, cause there's not a lot of progressive math rock bands in San Diego.
Yeah, you can count all of them on one
hand. Yeah. And most of them don't really exist anymore. Mm. So
yeah. Yeah. There used to be a scene.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we just play the same venues. But you know, it's kind of nice doing that, you know, with classical music, when you go and play a venue, there's, this whole like series of things you're supposed to do when you see a classical performance, like, you know, not talk when the performer is performing, which maybe is a good thing anyways, but then you clap when they're done. And if you see an orchestral performance, you don't clap between movements, but then at the end you have to do like, everyone stands and does a standing ovation, and then they do an encore, and it's just like all contrived bullshit,
right?
You know, and it takes away from the artistry of what those performers are doing to have this like ritual surrounding it that's just goofy, that no one, well, maybe some people genuinely feel it, but they're like 300 years old, you know. So it's nice doing music that elicits a real response from real people in a real place. And so yeah, doing this kind of music in like dive bars is more challenging in some ways, but in other ways it's about getting an organic response.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, like going back to the last song that we just listened to, like Plot Armor, there's towards the end those like spaces that we have, and also in Maudib, the spaces at the beginning, like no matter where we play at a bar, like you're going to hear people talking in those spaces. You're going to hear like conversations going on, people not paying attention, and that's like, I would rather hear that than just like dead silence or anything. Like I want people to be like experiencing the movement,
yeah,
the music organically.
You know, when we do hear silence or applause, it's genuine.
Yeah.
It's not out of expectation. So yeah, you can take it seriously.
Yeah.
I like that perspective. So it can be hard to be ignored when you're performing, but at the same time, it also can be hard to feel like everyone's only paying attention to you because they have to. Yeah, it's a good perspective.
I nod it.
Oh, cool. So if people want to learn more about your organization, where can they find it?
The internet.
Yeah? Yeah. I've heard of that.
Yeah. It's in the ocean where we throw our trash. You know what? If you would like to know more about fistfights and you haven't deleted your Facebook, you can go on Facebook. Same thing with the San Diego Music and Art Cooperative. And that's where we post most of our events. We're also on the Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And are we
at
on anything else?
Fistfights of Wolves.
Yeah. Can I give them your address if you want to show up at Ryan's house?
Yeah, just come hang out. We're on Spotify. We're on Bandcamp. Both of those. Just look up Fistfights with Wolves for the music.
Yeah. iTunes.
We are.
Ooh,
on iTunes,
fancy.
Right? And YouTube.
Ooh.
Yeah. I got all that stuff.
And now this podcast.
Yes.
And a podcast.
Yes.
Listen to the podcast 3 times.
And then San Diego Music and Art Cooperative. What's the web address?
Oh, sdmaac.com.
Yes.
Awesome. All right. Good deal. Thanks for coming to the studio, you guys.
Thank you.
It was great.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Oh, sure. Thank you for listening to episode number 6 of the Sunshine Sound Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can find more episodes at sunshinesoundcenter.org. We're also on iTunes, and you can subscribe on there. You can check out some updates and other stuff on our Facebook page and on Instagram. We also have a Twitter that we don't update too much, but you can look at that too. And if you want to contact me, you can email me at christine@sunshinesoundcenter.org. That's all I have for you today, so I hope you have a good one, and I'll talk to you again soon.